Hello and welcome to Groundwire, your community news from coast to coast to coast. Groundwire is a grassroots news program brought to you by the National Campus and Community Radio Association. This week's episode is produced by CHW Radio Western in London, Ontario, on the campus of Western University. On this week's episode...
We stand in solidarity with Mr. Mahajoub.
They were deceiving the First Nations along the route, and that's just not right.
I want to extend my deep condolences to the families of Tanya Nipanak, Carolyn Sinclair, and Lorna Blacksmith, and to the communities and the leadership and the families of each of these women who are coping with the loss of these loved ones.
This episode, we look at a protest in support of a Canadian detained by the government for over 10 years without a charge. We hear a report from Catherine Fisher on the Manitoba missing woman, and we listen to a story about the uneasy relationship between First Nation groups and the proposed Enbridge pipeline. But first, let's have a look at the headlines. We go now to Catherine Fisher with a report on the Manitoba missing women.
I want to extend my deep condolences to the families of Tanya Nipanak, Carolyn Sinclair, and Lorna Blacksmith, and to the communities and the leadership and the families of each of these women who are coping with the loss of these loved ones.
That is Assembly of Manitoba Grand Chief Derek Nipanak. In late June, a Winnipeg man was charged with three counts of second-degree murder in the deaths of three young Aboriginal women in that city, Tanya Nipanak, Caroline Sinclair, and Lorna Blacksmith. Police are not ruling out further charges and are talking with forces in other provinces to see if the alleged killer may be connected to cases elsewhere. In a public statement, Nipanak characterized Winnipeg's police response to the murders as slow and uncoordinated, and, while he thanks the police for the arrests, he says the generations of young Aboriginal women have come to urban environments for opportunities that haven't been there, and that the continued murders and disappearances of First Nations women have their roots in systemic discrimination. Nipanak went on to discuss national and provincial estimates of missing and murdered Aboriginal women in Canada.
Over the last 20 years, over 600 First Nations Aboriginal women and girls in Canada have been reported missing or murdered, and we believe that there may be many more. Our First Nations Aboriginal women account for 53% of all missing female cases in Manitoba. Almost half of the unsolved murder cases in Manitoba involve First Nations or Aboriginal women and girls.
A rally was held June 27th, and at least 200 people marched from Yonge Street and Broadway to the Manitoba Legislature honoring missing and murdered women in Manitoba and calling for a public inquiry.
I'm standing here in solidarity with the Manitoba Chiefs tonight, calling for a public inquiry, a national public inquiry, into why do we have so many women murdered and missing in this country.
Provincial Justice Minister Andrew Swan stated that the government doesn't want to get in the way of the criminal investigation into the murders at this time and that the government has no plans to instigate a public inquiry.
And now for your main stories. On June 26, Mohamed Majoub and his supporters rallied outside of Canada's notorious intelligence agency CSIS offices to protest 12 years of arbitrary detention for Mr. Majoub and to mark the International Day in Support of Victims of Torture.
To demand justice for Mr. Mohamed Majoub, a man who's been held in detention in Canada for 12 years and he has never been charged. I repeat myself, he has been held for 12 years and he has never been charged.
Yay.
There is no
evidence.
I've been detained in 12 years without a charge, without fair trial. It is not justice here. It is Islamophobia for CSIS and their ministers as well. A time has passed. I was asking the government of Canada to charge me or to release me. But now I have a very simple message, very simple demand to Jason Kenney and to victors immediately to withdraw the case against me, also to apologize to me and to my family here and in Egypt as well, and to clear my name.
Mr. Majoub, in terms of how he's been treated, first of all, as I said, the legislation itself is unfair because it requires secret trials. These secret trials cannot work. The special advocates, the people who see the secret evidence, don't have contact with Mr. Majoub. They can't defend Mr. Majoub effectively. And myself and my colleagues, his public counsel, can't defend it without knowing the secret evidence. So the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. There is no way to effectively defend Mr. Majoub. This is inherent in this oppressive and unjust law.
Detainees, we stand in solidarity with Mr. Mahajoub and his supporters and demand that the deeply flawed system of security certificates in Canada be abandoned and cases such as his be dealt with in full accordance with international human rights requirements. Any system which allows for the indefinite detention of a person for over 12 years must be regarded as an abject failure for the Canadian justice system and for human rights.
So we need to really stay in solidarity with this. We have to understand that people cannot be deported under this. This process is clearly flawed, it's unjust, it's discriminatory, and we cannot stand for that. So I come here to bring full solidarity from the Canadian auto workers with Mr. Majoub. Thank you. What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Now!
What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Now!
What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Now!
What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Now! Freedom for refugees!
In early June, the federal court fired 11 lawyers and legal assistants from Mr. Majoub's case for seizing his defense documents, but decided not to suspend the proceedings. Just last week, a federal court in a secret hearing ruled to exclude all summaries of evidence that have been destroyed by CSIS. This report was produced by Nanki Ray from No One Is Illegal Toronto. We go now to CFRO with a report on the Enbridge pipeline.
On June 5th, Enbridge announced that it had signed equity ownership agreements with 60% of the First Nations along the proposed BC-Alberta route of the Northern Gateway Pipeline. Spokesperson Paul Stanley said 23 First Nations have signed on. Art Sterrett says those figures are a sham. He is Executive Director of Coastal First Nations. That's an alliance of First Nations along BC's north and central coast and Haida Gwaii. Art Sterrett joins me by phone this morning. Hello, Art.
Good morning.
Now, why do you say those figures are a sham?
Well, I check the numbers. All of the First Nations from Prince George West right out to Haisla, and the Karyosakini Tribal Council, the Inca Dene, and the Lake Babine Band, and the Wet'suwet'en and the Morristown. And out of that group, I found that there were only two who had actually signed equity agreements. I was actually on an interview a while back as well, and the chief of Burns Lake was on there. He's one that they had signed an agreement, but they hadn't made up their mind whether they were supporting the project yet. They were just kind of signing on as a way to make sure that they didn't miss out on it, because Enbridge had put a deadline on it. So part of the problem is that Enbridge is, they're exaggerating who actually is supporting the project based on signing agreements. And the other side is most of the people that actually signed agreements are outside of the pipeline route. So I know of four others that Enbridge claims have signed equity agreements in the north, but those four are outside of the pipeline route. They don't have rights and title on the route, and thus they're not going to be in a position to decide one way or another whether this pipeline goes ahead.
I heard the interview with Al Jarrow of the Burns Lake Indian Band, and so he has signed an agreement, but the agreement is not going to come into force unless he gets approval from his band members. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, and that's a responsible way to do it. One of the problems that we have with this whole process, though, is that Enbridge is somehow trying to change the law. What they're telling First Nations along the route is that there's a timeline on consultation, and there isn't.
you know, if a project, in the next decade or so ends up going ahead, it doesn't matter if you sign an equity agreement now or if you signed one a month ago or you never signed one. The law says, you know, if you're going to impact the First Nation, there has to be an accommodation, and there's no timeline on that. So Enbridge was pulling a few tricks on First Nations by saying that there's a deadline for accommodation, and that's actually against the law. So they were deceiving the First Nations along the route, and that's just not right. So
even the people who actually have territory on the route are being deceived by Enbridge. But then, in addition to that, they're including people who you say don't have Aboriginal title. For example, the Métis. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, the Métis. Certainly, everybody recognizes that the Métis have rights. You know, everybody has rights, and you know, there are a lot of the Métis that, you know, they hunt and fish and that with the local First Nations, but the Métis themselves will tell you that they don't have any land. And they certainly don't have any land along the route. And so for Enbridge to sign an agreement with the Métis Nation to approve a pipeline is a bit deceiving. The BC Métis Federation has canvassed or polled all of their locals, and they say that over 90% of them are actually opposed to this project. And I have had many, many calls from Métis people who have said what the Métis Nation did was wrong. It was an insult to the First Nations along the route, and that the Métis didn't feel it was proper that they come out and do this.
So in a sense, there's a split within the Métis community, and there was also a split in the Gitxkan community between chiefs who signed and people who didn't want to sign. Is that something that's happening in a number of nations?
Well, I mean, you know, the coastal First Nations did, many, many years of research on oil and pipelines and tankers, and, you know, what we found in the Gulf of Mexico, what we found in Alaska is that when oil comes into an area, one of the things that they do to try and have their way is they divide people. And so this is par for the course. You know, Enbridge has obviously divided the Métis. They have divided First Nations along the route by including some that aren't on the route. And indeed, the most dramatic one was when they signed an agreement with one person from the Gitxkan. All of the chiefs subsequently came in after and told their chief negotiator that this agreement was not acceptable to them. Now, the Gitxkan have told Enbridge that they are not going to be part of the agreement. But Enbridge says, too bad, you signed and you're staying with it. So obviously Enbridge wants to continue to divide the Gitxkan people, which is unfair. But that's what oil does. So, you know, we shouldn't be surprised. Enbridge will do whatever it can to divide First Nations. It will do whatever it can to divide British Columbians. And all of the false ads that they're putting out there right now are intended to do that. So they're trying to paint a good light on what they're doing. You know, they don't want us to know that, you know, Enbridge itself, their pipelines have, you know, 60 to 70 spills a year. They don't want us to know that every 1.5 days in Alberta there's a spill somewhere. They don't want us to know that they spilled, half a million liters of oil in on Kalamazoo. And, you know, they don't want us to know that there's a 250,000 liter spill in Alberta right now. The Premier of Alberta comes out and makes it sound like this is some kind of an unusual occurrence by having a spill there. But the reality is there are spills every 1.5 days in Alberta. And, you know, Alberta wants British Columbia to become their sewer. You know, they are defacing their land in Alberta with oil. And British Columbia has a sustainable economy. You know, it's not in the greatest shape. The world is having a tough time, but we're in better shape than most. You know, we don't need to bring oil with the potential to wipe out the salmon runs, to defile our water. You know, we in British Columbia are self-sufficient, and we don't need to subject ourselves to an industry that is non-renewable and that has no respect for the environment. We've learned just recently that Enbridge has been fighting with the Department of Fisheries and Oceans now since 2010, and they lobbied the government something like 40 times last year. And as a result of that, we are now getting Fisheries Act changes to allow them to do whatever they want. They have no respect for water. They have no respect for rivers. And they couldn't beat the rules that were in place, so they've got the government to change them. And we saw all that in Parliament this week. So we're in for a big battle in British Columbia, but we're up to the challenge. British Columbians and First Nations are not going to allow this to happen. And the one thing that British Columbians can take heart with is the fact that all of these laws that were changed in Ottawa have not changed the Aboriginal rights and title of First Nations in British Columbia. And we will use those rights to make sure that the environment that British Columbians respect and cherish are going to be there for future generations.
What is the dollar value of the equity agreement that Enbridge is offering?
Well, they're saying that it is 10% of the project. That to me is a real joke as well. I mean, the Mackenzie Valley pipeline, for example, is 33%. You know, the other pipeline, Pacific Trails, that's an LNG pipeline that's heading for Kitimat. The equity agreements for First Nations, and there are 30%. So what Enbridge is doing is an absolute joke. I mean, even if First Nations found this project acceptable, the equity agreements that they're offering are a joke. You know, they're less than a third of what's been negotiated in other areas, and Enbridge, through their trickery, has caused First Nations to think that there's some kind of deadline and accommodation, and have gotten a few people to sign up. By the way, I think that even those along the pipeline, despite the fact that they're against this, you know, some of them are in tough shape. They've lost jobs, you know, they've had mills burned down, the forest industry is in tough shape as a result of the pine beetle, and they're just trying to cobble together a new economy. And so Coastal First Nations is looking at non-renewables as well as some, you know, an LNG to see whether or not somehow non-renewables can help support the renewable industry. Enbridge isn't trying to do that. Enbridge just wants to bowl their way through here and do whatever they want. And they know that their industry is going to jeopardize everything that we do in British Columbia, but they really don't care.
What kind of jobs are going to be created? I know they talk about 15% of jobs going to First Nations people. What kind of jobs are they?
Well, Enbridge is saying that they are making room for First Nations to get 15% of the jobs, but they're very careful to say that that's only in the construction phase. If it was the permanent jobs, they're saying that there might be 500 jobs all across Canada created by this pipeline, and there might be a couple hundred in British Columbia. So if First Nations, even if they did offer 15% to First Nations of the permanent jobs, that would only be 30 jobs. So, I mean, it's a joke to think that somehow this is going to solve the unemployment problem that's running rampant on First Nations territories. Enbridge exaggerates their numbers. When they say 500 and they stretch that all across Canada, I would assume that probably most of those are in their head offices in Toronto and Calgary and places like that, or Houston, wherever their offices might be. But they really aren't offering anything. You know, on the coast of British Columbia, there are 30,000 jobs that depend on a healthy environment, that depends on the ocean being able to continue to provide salmon and halibut and black cod and crab and shellfish and everything else. One spill, and that's over. $2.5 billion of revenue a year on the coast of sustainable development, and that's growing. That isn't even counting the 12,000 jobs in the sport fishing and tourism industry. You know, there are ships that go up and down this coast. You know, people look at BC as being pristine, and they come to the coast and they go to the interior, and it's all one package. And so if you defile one part of the province, you really do take away the majesty of British Columbia and just make us another dumping ground.
Now, it's no secret that the Conservatives passed Bill C-38 in order to facilitate getting the oil from the tar sands out to the coast. But you say that's going to make no difference.
It won't make any difference. There's nothing that they have done in Parliament that changes Aboriginal rights and title. And we're up to the challenge. You know, one of the things that we're doing in British Columbia, we have rewritten the law around rights and title. British Columbia is unique in Canada. There have been very few settlements for title, and Aboriginal rights and title exist almost throughout the whole province. First Nations are being supported by the lawyers that helped us do that, and many of them, because of how they see the bullying tactics of the feds, they know that we don't have a lot of money, but most of them are now saying that they're going to work for us pro bono. So we're not concerned about having to raise too much money. Obviously, we'll need some resources, but the reality is, if we don't raise any, we're still going to be up to the challenge, and we don't have to raise a whole bunch of money to fight these guys. We have so many people in Canada and British Columbia that are willing to support us that we're going to take this all the way to the Supreme Court if we have to.
It's been good to talk to you this morning, Art.
Thanks for calling.
I've been speaking with Art Sterrett. He is Executive Director of Coastal First Nations.
And now it's time for the Community Radio Report, produced by Gunarji O'Sullivan in CFRO Vancouver.
What we'd like to do is invite our guest, our host here, Woody Morrison. He's going to read the resolutions that were presented at the NCRA plenary, okay?
This is the shortest one. This was moved by Gunarji, seconded by Spencer Lindsay. Whereas NCRC host station exists on the traditional territory or territories of Indigenous nations in what is now known as Canada, and whereas host stations must act as respectful guests on said territory or territories and create welcoming space for Indigenous delegations or delegates. Motion. Be it resolved that the conference guide for every preceding NCRC must include an acknowledgement of the traditional territory or territories in which it is taking place, the name or names of the elder facilitating the traditional welcome, and a list of Indigenous organizations and other resources in the local area. How does this motion fit within the mandate of NCRA? The motion will help fulfill Aboriginal initiatives identified in the 2011-2013 NCRA strategic objectives by A, creating spaces and initiating dialogues that will encourage increased participation by Indigenous delegates and community members of the host territories, and B, increasing recognition of diverse Indigenous perspectives.
So that was one great motion that it will support, you know, First Nations inclusion at our conferences, and this is a great way to do it. Dana, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
So what did you think as we were presenting this motion to the people and how it supports decolonizing the airwaves of, you know, through this association and this motion?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a couple of things that I wanted to address, you know, thinking back to that motion. And one of the most important parts about that motion to me is that it came from a group of Indigenous people involved in radio. And, you know, it was like a combined effort where we really, you know, came together, we thought it through, you know, we went over the wording carefully over and over, and that's the language that is used in that motion is also, you know, it's very deliberate, like it was well thought out. And I especially the, you know, in the part of the motion when it says, you know, the area now known as Canada. And I think that that's important because it speaks to this idea that there were people here before Canada was created as a state. And it also pays respect to the idea that there were nations here and sovereign people. And the respectful guest part is also very important, right? Because it harks back to the same idea that everywhere in Canada, North America is Indigenous land, and how we want to start, you know, that's where we want to start with all these kinds of meetings, is remembering that these are all Indigenous lands. There are Indigenous peoples here. They need to be respected, and everyone else who is here needs to act as a respectful guest. And I think that that's a great start, putting that into the program.
One of the things, you know, this, Woody, one of the things I would have put in there, too, is that not only do we acknowledge the traditional territory in which this radio station is broadcasting, but we should be able to greet our listeners with the language of that area.
But then there's another motion that was made as well, and some of that does include inclusion of language and territories and such. So, Woody, can you read that for us too, please?
The 2011-2012 NCRA strategic objectives have identified the need to increase recognition of Indigenous issues and perspectives across the NCRA and increase capacity to revitalize Indigenous language and culture. And whereas it is the collective responsibility of all the people, Indigenous or non-Indigenous, to collaborate in the fight toward decolonization. And whereas irregular grant funding often threatens to stall initiatives of the Native Caucus motion, be it resolved that the NRCA support the Native Caucus in the implementation of the following non-grant reliant initiatives: encouraging the NCRA stations to produce station IDs that acknowledge the traditional territory or territories in which their stations reside. Preliminary planning of an annual decolonization marathon that focuses on issues critical to Indigenous communities that are not only adequately covered by mainstream media. Be it further resolved that the NCRA and the NCRC 2013 host station support the following initiatives at the NCRC 2013. A hands-on workshop facilitated by the Native Caucus that will help delegates produce a short PSA acknowledging the traditional territory of their stations. The invitation and involvement of local Indigenous programmers as delegates and staff of local Indigenous organizations to host workshops. Other workshops that will encourage intercultural collaboration and build capacity to cover Indigenous issues respectfully, issues such as access to water, large-scale resource development, grave desecration. How does this motion fit within the mandate of the NCRA? It said it supports previous motions made by Isabel O'Kanese, Janet Rogers, and Elder Mary Rose Barefoot Jones, and late Nesky Manuel.
And that's all the time we have for Groundwire this week. Groundwire is a grassroots news program brought to you by the National Campus and Community Radio Association. All of our episodes are available for listening and podcasting at groundwire.ncra.ca. If you're interested in contributing as a journalist, get in touch with us by email at groundwire@ncra.ca. That's groundwire@ncra.ca. This edition was produced by Ed Von Attercass at CHRW Radio Western in London, Ontario. We thank contributors Carly Forbes, Catherine Fisher, Gunarji O'Sullivan, Sumbal Saba, Laura Sullivan, Nanki Ray, and the people at CFRO. This has been Ed Von Attercass. From all of us at Groundwire, thanks for listening.